we discuss the U.S. Department of Interior's work to rename geographic locations here in Wisconsin and other states that contain a slur that is racist and sexist to Indigenous women. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could join us on a Friday. In Wisconsin, the department identified 28 sites in 19 counties. The public comment period closes Monday. And to date, nearly 6,000 comments have been registered, according to the federal government's regulations portal. Join in with your feelings about removing the S word and questions you have about this task force work, 800-642-1234. Michael Tischler is chair of the Interior Department's Derogatory Geographic Names Task Force. He is director of the National Geospatial Program at the U.S. Geological Survey, or USGS. Mike, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Well, let's start out with the why. Explain to us why this work of changing the names of these places is a high priority for the federal government.
It's a great question. Secretary Holland was the one that really started this effort last November, and she recognized that the term that you mentioned is one that has historically been used as an offensive ethnic, racial, and sexist slur, particularly targeted toward Indigenous women. And this was something that she really felt needed correction, and it was in her authority and her work with the Board on Geographic Names within the Department of Interior that we're able to move forward on her desire.
There are around 660 places nationally expected to be renamed. The department is seeking public comment. As we mentioned, thousands of comments coming in. How does that compare to how the features were named originally? What is the process of this name changing?
It's a great question. So we've worked the Board on Geographic Names and the staff that supports that. And the board itself is an interagency group composed of any federal agencies that have an interest in federal mapping or produce federal mapping products. And it's been around for over 100 years. And in that time, the staff and the members have worked to consolidate and standardize the names that are used to describe all of these geographic features. So some of the names that that we're considering under this review process are the original names and have been there, at least the names as we know them. They've been there for some time, since the 50s or 60s or earlier, depending on the kind of evidence that we're able to find or the historical record. The name change process that we have right now is an accelerated version of a process that's been around for quite some time. The Board on Geographic Names has taken proposals to either name unnamed features or to rename features that are on the landscape. And that's a very deliberative process that's focused on outreach and getting opinions from the local community that's involved in the name, from tribal entities, from local and state government, from land management agencies at the federal government. But this accelerated process was necessary and put in place by the Secretary's order last November to really look at removing that derogatory term more quickly and coming up with replacement names in a shorter period of time.
I find it interesting that your agency is doing this work, leading this work, because I don't think of USGS in this light, and I think of you doing measurements on water tables and collecting mineral samples, measuring earthquakes. And it was really a lesson to me, I think, that every organization has expertise and a will from within, an ability to help our nation become less racist, less discriminatory. And I wonder, what does it look like for you to lead this work as a leader in USGS?
You know, that's a great observation. I'm surprised myself when I go to work most days at just how broad the mission of the U.S. Geological Survey has become. And we've migrated over time, I think, from the roots, which started in mapping, but it includes science about ecosystems and invasive species and even looking at wildlife health. And in addition to the things that most people might typically think about when they hear USGS, stream gauges and volcanoes and earthquakes. But the mapping program, at least the program that I run at USGS, that's part of the reason the USGS was stood up in the late 1800s, was to help map the West. And that mission has remained, and that's part of the reason why the U.S. Geological Survey, and my program in particular, was asked to help and to lead this effort. I mentioned that this group, the Board on Geographic Names, the position I have as director of the National Geospatial Program allows me to be the Department of Interior member on that board. In addition, some of the staff that are part of my program are the permanent staff that support that board. Hmm. We're the ones that maintain the authoritative database of geographic names across the landscape for federal use. So if you're interested in changing the names or interested in any work regarding these geographic names, it makes sense that the USGS is at least involved in the conversation, if not leading it. In addition, many of the names that we're considering under this review, they do occur on federal land, land that's owned by the federal government. Most of those land management agencies are in the Department of Interior, the Bureau of Land Management, Fish and Wildlife Service, National Park Service. And then, of course, we also have on our task force helping us representatives from the Forest Service and the Department of Agriculture as a large land management agency.
Really sweeping across agencies. I'm going to reintroduce you, talking with the chair of the U.S. Department of the Interior's Derogatory Geographic Names Task Force, Mike Tischler, with us. Task Force, part of the National Geospatial Program at USGS, working to rename 660 geological features containing a slur, including 28 in Wisconsin. Your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Emily now in Milwaukee. Emily, hi, go ahead.
Good morning. Hi, I'm totally supportive of the project. And the question I had is, since it seems so obvious now that the term has such an offensive kind of meaning, at the time, why is it such a popular name, I guess? Like, at the time that this name was selected for these places, did it have some other, maybe like less malicious meaning? I'm just kind of curious how it got to be that we have over 600 that use this name, since it's so problematic.
Emily, thank you.
It's a great question, and I think each of these names, one of the more interesting parts of this job is understanding what is the history and origin of a lot of these names, and what does it mean to the local community. I think the secretary really highlighted that most of the public now view this, and most of tribal governments and Native Americans across the country do view this name as derogatory. And I, at least in working through this names issue, it seems like many of these names, it wasn't at one point in time they all became named. It happened over time. It could have been with settling the West or even later. And it could have been used for a variety of reasons. The reason why summits and creeks and rivers and lakes all have this descriptor, I really don't know why people chose to put that particular name. What I do find interesting is that it's while the majority of people seem, and we see this in the public comments and in our discussions, do recognize this is a derogatory term, it's not universally recognized that way. And even with some Native Americans, there are tribes and that from the language where this term originates that don't view it that way. They think it's just an adjective, it's a descriptor. But yet you still have many other Native American tribes that do, and they're very hurtful. It's very hurtful for them to see this name on the landscape, particularly with the reverence they have for the features, the physical features, the mountains and the lakes and the creeks, to have them what they view as an ugly word. These names have changed over time. In about the last 20 years that the Board on Geographic Names has been working with this, we've changed a couple hundred of these SQ features, but that still leaves a lot on the landscape. So I think that was another reason why Secretary Holland really felt it was necessary from her level to enact action, because we weren't able to, the process we have to rename these features relies on proposals from the public. We don't self-generate the names. We don't rename things ourselves. It relies on somebody from the public or a state or government agency submitting a proposal to change a name.
I want to pick up on that proposal from the public. In 2020, a Wisconsin lake had its name changed from that slur to Amber Lake. And Tom Paulson Jr., who's a member of the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians, was really a leader in moving to that change proposal, getting that name changed. And he first made a proposal in the 90s. Here he is talking to his daughters.
Seeing them growing up in the atmosphere of that word and them dealing with it with the high school down here, being then integrated of tribal members and kids in the community. And when my granddaughter was born, I decided at that moment that she was not going to know that that name existed.
That audio courtesy of Native Report. And Mike, you see there that this generation wanting their granddaughter, the next generation, not to have to deal with that word. And I thought that was a real powerful viewpoint there.
Yeah, we see that echoed in a lot of different tribal communities. from across the country that particularly the older women who have had to grow up with this term, they don't want to see it there anymore. They recognize that it's hurtful, and they don't want their generation to recognize it either. And we're just pleased to be a part of that process and to do justice to the names and to do the work we can to come up with a name that communities involved are happy and proud of.
Mike Tischler with us, chairing the Interior Department's Derogatory Geographic Names Task Force, directs the National Geospatial Program at the U.S. Geological Survey, the USGS. Let's get at your questions, your comments about the federal government's plans to change the derogatory names of places across the country here in Wisconsin, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute with Mike Tischler here on the Ideas Network. A federal order from the Interior Department puts renaming more than 660 geographic locations in the U.S. on a fast track that use a racial slur for Native American women. We're talking about the task force's work here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Late last year, Oneida Nation Councilwoman Jennifer Webster reflected on this effort, telling WBAY-TV,
derogatory racial slurs are nothing new to Indigenous people. Historically and unfortunately, it puts women in a negative light.
Join in 800-642-1234. Mike Tischler, chair of the U.S. Department of the Interior's Derogatory Geographic Names Task Force, with us for about 9 more minutes. So, Mike, as you see nearly 6,000 comments in at the moment, how do you sift through these comments? What do they mean to this work?
There's a lot of ways to take that in. We're happy to have public comments from any individual or any groups, and we're seeing comments that are from organized entities and from state names authorities, and that's really what we want to see. The process that we have right now, in order to remove the names that were there, we had to come up with something to rename these derogatory geographic name features, and we developed a slate of candidate names, but we came up with what we thought was an objective process. And that is really in lieu of receiving any proposals we have from the public. So what we have with all of these public comments allow us to do is get more familiar with the terms that communities themselves would like to put on these features, and helps us in that proposal generating process. We're treating these almost as proposals. And that's been incredibly helpful. It will take time to sift through each one of those to determine which ones are just supportive comments. Like we've heard this morning that, you know, we think this is a derogatory name and action needs to be taken place. That's great to hear, but it doesn't recognize a specific feature with a specific recommended term or comment on one of the candidate names we're replacing. We also hear from communities that are not happy about this. They don't want the name to be changed. They don't think there's a reason to. And we may get, like I mentioned, state names authorities, which are sort of at the state level, the authoritative groups that are in charge of the state group of names. We hear from them with a list of the names and their features, list of features in their state and what their comments or recommendations might be for those. So it will take some time to sift through those and figure out which ones are regarding and have a strong proposal or recommendation for a particular feature versus which ones are supportive, which ones are not, or which ones are just offering maybe additional context about the history of a name.
How did you come up with candidate names?
We wanted to come up with a process that was somewhat repeatable and objective. We don't want to be in a position where we're generating the names. And that was difficult in this situation. We were asked to figure out what do you replace a name with. So what we did, the first thing we did was we identified where these derogatory names were. And there were about 650, a little more, across the country. For each one of those names, we looked in the neighboring area on the landscape and found the nearest 5 geographic features that are already named. So for example, if you have a feature that's SQ Mesa out in Arizona, the nearest feature might be Crystal Creek. So we might consider the new name being Crystal Mesa. And we did that so that it was, number one, we're mapping people and it's a spatial technique. It's something we're familiar with. And we had the data to support that. But those other names that we considered, they're accepted and used already. So it is to associate a name that's already in use with another feature gave gave to me some confidence that these names were going to be accepted. And now we have for each of these SQ features, we've got five that we can work through. So if the first one is not a good fit, maybe it's too generic. Maybe another one is a commemorative feature named for a particular person that we wouldn't want to apply to a different feature. We've got some to choose from. And of course, any comments we get or feedback we have through the tribal consultations we offered, through state names authorities, we'll prioritize those names we get from the public and from tribes ahead of those candidate features, because what we're really after is what the communities and tribes think.
Who will ultimately decide then on what candidate name prevails?
The way the process works right now, you mentioned, I think, at the top of this, that the public comment period and tribal consultation period is going to end next Monday. After that, the task force that was stood up in late last year under the secretary's order, we have 90 days to review all of the information that we've gathered through public comment, through tribal consultation, feedback about these individual, the candidate names. At the end of those 90 days, or before, if we finish our work early, we'll come up with a single recommendation for each of these features as to what the replacement name should be. That list of recommendations will go to the Board on Geographic Names, the Domestic Names Committee. And then after we submit to them our recommendations, that board has 60 days to render a decision on all of those features. Mm-hmm. And the Board on Geographic Names is the federal authority, so they're the ones that are really adjudicating these approvals.
We're talking about this federal effort to rename geographical features in our country that use a native slur. We have Mike Tischler with us, chair of the U.S. Department of the Interior's Derogatory Geographic Names Task Force, working with his colleagues across multiple agencies. And you can join in on this work, 800-642-1234. Mike, how is the task force responding to criticism over name changes? There is that argument that changing the name is the government's effort at erasing history.
We've heard that through some of the public comments and some other conversations that we have. And I've mentioned that we really don't want to be the ones that are seen as putting the names on the landscape. That's why we're hopeful to have proposals from the public. And I think it's important to recognize that the database we use and the names that we're keeping, we recognize that they're used for academic and archival purposes, and they are historical. So even if all of these features have their name changed to something else, the SQ name is going to be stored in the database as a variant. And what that means is that that history will still be there for people that are interested in how that name has changed or how those names were used across the country. Will still be available in the database to help people understand where these occurred, how they changed, what time they changed. So we're hopeful that that will still allow us to look into this from an academic perspective, to study this if people would like to in the future.
So what happens to places like a city in northern Minnesota that has this name? How is the department reconciling with the idea that this slur will still exist in other places?
The Board on Geographic Names, it's really about the scope in this place. We look at mostly physical features on the landscape, creeks and rivers and canyons. We don't deal with most populated places in cities and towns. That's not in the scope, and I think that's probably correct. It's not our job to rename Madison, Wisconsin. It's a populated place, and there's a town council that if they would like to change their name, that's something they can do. I doubt there's a desire to do that, but that's why we're not really concerned with those types of features right now. I think there's recognition that there are some that's still going to be on the landscape in some places, but it's not our job. It's the local community's job to figure out what name they feel is right for them.
Sometimes name changes can take decades as people push proposals and explain why. And I'm wondering if this project, this expedited task force work, will set into motion some of these proposals that haven't been able to affect change.
Interestingly, when the secretary signed this order last November, she signed a second one the same day. And that was looking at a little bit of a different effort, but related. And what that order is going to do is set up a federal advisory committee. And that's the formal mechanism through which the federal government can receive advice and feedback from the public. And what that federal advisory committee is going to be doing is providing their opinions on what other names are out there that might be considered derogatory or offensive, particularly for federal land units. These are things like national parks or national monuments or national refuges. And that process is going to be led by the Park Service. I think they're in the process right now of determining the makeup of that federal advisory committee. Hmm. But that's something I'll be personally following closely, because I'm curious to see from that advisory committee what names they think are do need further consideration, whether they're considered derogatory or offensive, or that some other action needs to take place.
Mike, thank you for joining us and sharing this work.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Mike Tischler is chair of the U.S. Department of Interior's Derogatory Geographic Names Task Force, director of the National Geospatial Program at the USGS, the U.S. Geological Survey. We have a link to the public comment page on proposed name changes, as well as the link to the Federal Board on Geographic Names. You can find them at WPR.org/mornings. Ahead this hour, we take stock of redistricting with reaction from a veteran political journalist and how the map-making process played out in the courts. 800-642-1234 to join in. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Mary Kate McCoy brings us a story about braving the Beltline during rush hour.
You know that bubbling dread you feel as you approach bumper-to-bumper traffic? Or that anxiety and frustration as an aggressive driver cuts you off? It's safe to say most drivers have unfortunately felt those irritations at one point or another. For writer Micey Vang of Sun Prairie, nothing brings those emotions out quite like driving on Madison's notorious Beltline during rush hour.
We've all heard the joke. Wisconsin has two seasons, winter and road construction. Master driving in these two environments, and you can pretty much handle anything life throws at you. If you're in the Madison area, just mastering the infamous Beltline during busy times is an achievement all its own. I have driven in some of the largest, busiest, and most congested cities in the U.S. I've navigated LA traffic, taking literally hours to simply drive across town. I've sped down Chicago highways, going 20 over the limit, and I was still the slowest moving car. I've survived Dallas freeways, connections, and confusion, where your risk of an automobile accident is almost 50 times greater than the national average. But I bet if you took drivers from any of those cities and plopped them on the Beltline, they'd likely tell you driving on the Beltline during rush hour is an experience like no other. I absolutely love the Madison area. I came here after high school to attend UW-Madison, and I never left. But I have always marveled at how we thought building the city on an isthmus was a good idea. If you're on one edge of town, you either maneuver your way through the isthmus or find your way up or down and around the city to reach the other side. No matter which way you choose, you're crossing bridges, bodies of water, ascending hills and descending valleys, and winding your way through narrow streets and neighborhoods. The Beltline is one major thoroughfare, and it has become a lifeline for navigating the Madison area. Find yourself on the Beltline during the busy hours, and you may actually spend more time on the road than if you had just waited for a less busy traffic period. And chances are, you likely would have arrived at the same time. I'm awed when I read the huge electronic traffic signs hovering over or on the side of the road and see that the estimated time to my exit is much longer than if I were to simply get out of my car and walk to my destination. Now, I don't even look at my approximate arrival times. I only read the signs for their witty safety messages. At times, I have actually exited the Beltline and re-entered, improving my position in line by maybe a couple of cars. No, it didn't actually equate to any time saved, but it did make me feel like I had some control and was making progress. Now, don't get me wrong. Driving the Beltline can provide quite a bit of entertainment and people watching. One of my all-time favorites is to see someone angrily and dangerously speed ahead, only to find us at the exact same spot together a few moments later. Nothing was accomplished but the consumption of a bunch of fuel. Another interesting situation, the lane that you're not in always seems to be moving faster than your lane, until you move into it, of course. What is it that makes navigating the infamous Beltline so remarkable, so frustrating, and so difficult? Is it the toll that harsh Wisconsin winters take on the roads? Is it that some or most of the Beltline seems to always be under construction and causing delays? Or maybe it's the diverse mix of drivers, all with unique, inconsistent, and unpredictable driving styles. Whatever the reason, to truly understand, you'll need to experience what this chaotic highway is all about. Grab your keys and take a drive on the Beltline during its busiest time of day.
Damn this traffic jam, how I hate to be late. It hurts my motor to go so slow. Damn this traffic jam, time to get home myself.
Writer Micey Vang brought us that story about braving the Beltline during rush hour. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
And now to redistricting. 1 week ago, the state Supreme Court adopted Republican-drawn maps for the state legislature, reversing course after the U.S. Supreme Court threw out Governor Evers' maps. Also 1 week ago, the first day on which candidates under Wisconsin law could begin to circulate nomination papers. We take stock of the redistricting cycle with your map-making questions, your observations, 800-642-1234. Craig Gilbert is a fellow at the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education at Marquette University Law School. He retired earlier this year as the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, covering Wisconsin politics for more than three decades. Craig, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be with you.
Well, this morning I read a letter to the editor published yesterday in the Wausau Pilot and Review, and I just want to read a few lines. It starts out, "Dear editor, partisan justices on Wisconsin's Supreme Court have approved a formula for one-party control of Wisconsin government. They adopted state legislative district maps that were extremely gerrymandered to favor Republicans." And the letter ended by quoting Lincoln's Gettysburg Address in 1863, "Government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth." What is your assessment of what happened in this map cycle?
Well, we started out, you know, with a pretty deep gerrymander that, you know, over the last 10 years from the map that was adopted in 2011 by Republicans when they had control of the governor's office and the legislature. So 10 years of a very skewed map that pretty much guaranteed large Republican majorities in the legislature under kind of almost any election circumstances, good years for Republicans, bad years for Republicans. The outcome was pretty much the same. The new maps are arguably even more one-sided than the old maps. For example, in the state assembly, you've now got 63 Republican-leaning seats, depending on how you measure it. That's a built-in advantage of about 27 seats in the 99-seat assembly. Under the previous maps, it was about 61 or 62 Republican seats, so it's gone up. There are fewer competitive districts under the new map than there were under the old map. Not by a lot, but even fewer. And the old map, you know, did a lot to reduce competition in legislative races to begin with. So in one sense, it's pretty familiar territory, a pretty deep gerrymander and kind of baked in outcomes for the legislature. In another sense, it's you know, arguably even more problematic than the old map.
Let's take a call. Jane joining us from Suamico. Jane, hi, go ahead. What would you like to say about the maps?
I'd like to ask him to speak to the least changes rule. This is a rule that the Supreme Court created out of whole cloth that said the maps that were so gerrymandered from 10 years ago needed to be considered and have the least changes possible to those maps when the new maps were created. Now we have even more hyper-gerrymandered maps. Are we stuck with this for decades?
Craig Gilbert.
So, yeah, we're talking about a ruling by the state Supreme Court. You know, there have been a lot of important stops along the legal pathway to where we are today. mostly setbacks for Democrats and victories for Republicans, with a conservative majority in the U.S. Supreme Court and a conservative majority in the state Supreme Court. And this was one of the most important ones, because the state Supreme Court ruled that whatever map it was going to accept, and the maps were in dispute because you had a Democratic governor and a Republican controlled legislature, whatever map, the final map would have to be a map that minimized changes to the previous map. And what that meant was, you know, that created, that made the previous map, which was very gerrymandered, and the product of a law passed in 2011, it made that the baseline for the next map. So it basically extended the life of the previous gerrymander in a way that really narrowed the options, and meant that even maps at this point that were proposed by the Democratic governor in the aftermath of this legal ruling were very good for Republicans. They just weren't as good for Republicans as the Republican map. So the choice became between a very gerrymandered map that was that just absolutely maximized the number of Republican seats in the legislature, and a map that wasn't quite as good for Republicans, but still very good for Republicans. And, you know, there has been a lot of debate over this ruling, including whether, how much of a legal sort of foundation there is for this concept of least change.
Jane also is asking, is she stuck with these district lines for the next decade?
So that's an interesting question. Normally the answer would be yes, and it may be yes in this case, but the way this ruling came down, it was the byproduct of a series of court decisions at the state and federal level, some of which involved the Voting Rights Act. There's no doubt that Democrats are going to go to court after this election cycle and challenge those rulings. So you will see more litigation after the 2022 election. This map is in place for this year's election in November, but you'll see more litigation. What the prospects are for that litigation, it's hard to say. It's probably, I wouldn't necessarily bet on changes to the map. The Republicans could come back if they win the race for governor in 2022 and try to change the congressional map. We've been talking about the legislative map, but the congressional map represented a modest victory for Democrats because the state Supreme Court actually adopted the maps, the last map drawn by Democratic Governor Tony Evers, and it increased the number of competitive congressional districts from 1 to 2.
Mm-hmm.
So a little more competition, and that, that drew objections from Republicans because it took a safe Republican seat in southeastern Wisconsin and made it more competitive. So you could see attempts in court to change the maps in both directions, depending on whether you're talking about the congressional map or the legislative map.
We have a veteran political journalist, Craig Gilbert, with us, stays with us on this redistricting cycle, how it fits into the historical context of map making in Wisconsin through time. Still time to join in on the courts and the power of drawing maps. What you saw here, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Craig Gilbert here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about redistricting in our state, how it played out in the courts. Here's Assembly Speaker Robin Voss on our program in late October as Republicans and Democrats work to draw up their own maps.
But I think the most important thing is making sure that we follow all of the constitutional guidelines, one person, one vote, protecting communities of color, ensuring that we have the ability for communities of interest to stay together. And in the end, I am very confident that the map we produce will meet all of those constitutional challenges.
Your thoughts on this redistricting cycle, 800-642-1234. Craig Gilbert covered Wisconsin politics for decades for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, now a fellow at Marquette University Law School, with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in Maggie now in Madison. Maggie, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hey. So I have lived in communities both in the city and in rural areas. And I like to joke that I am too conservative for my liberal friends and too liberal for my conservative friends. But my real question is, I think that there's a lot of real concern in areas that are majority Republican and majority Democrat about not being represented appropriately and having state-level representatives that essentially like won't represent their interests. And so I'm just really concerned about, A, you know, what we can do to prevent ourselves from being in echo chambers, and also what things are happening to help increase bipartisan communication.
Maggie, thank you for that. Craig, go ahead.
So it's a challenge when, you know, we live in a world where many parts of Wisconsin are becoming, are red and becoming redder, and other parts are blue and becoming bluer. And there are fewer purple communities. And so that kind of works in concert with gerrymandering to really kind of destroy electoral competition in these district-based elections. And that kind of works against bipartisanship because the incentives within these one-sided districts to kind of go to, you know, kind of cross political lines or find common ground, the incentives are you know, what worries incumbents politically are the threats they face from their own side, not from the other side, because these districts are just not competitive. So these are pretty big challenges when it comes to kind of overcoming all these forces. And again, it's not simply the way the maps are drawn. It's also sort of the shifts in the underlying political landscape in the state toward more one-sided communities and also toward more partisan voting behavior on the part of voters. The fact that fewer voters cross over and vote for the other party and fewer voters split their tickets also kind of, you know, gives the gerrymander more power because the results are sort of baked into the map. They're baked into the way the lines are drawn. And they're kind of impervious to the kinds of political swings we used to see.
Is there anything that Maggie and others can do, as Maggie says, to prevent political echo chambers and to improve that one person, one vote?
That's a tough question. I mean, I think, you know, certainly communication helps, and that means, you know, Democrats talking to Republicans and Republicans talking to Democrats, you know, communication at the grassroots level, communication, you know, if you're a Democratic voter, communication with your Republican representative and vice versa. I mean, to try to, you know, kind of create incentives for elected officials to not ignore voters on the other side of that divide. And so, you know, I think anything that can sort of, you know, work toward making our politics kind of less kind of robotically partisan and contentious is helpful.
Mm. Robotically partisan. Interesting. Maggie, thank you so much for calling in. John now in Racine. John, hi.
Hello. I want to just agree that there certainly is not one person, one vote. When everybody was in school, we learned that that's how it should be. In fact, that's how democracy is defined. And we're living at more of a two-thirds, one-third vote today in terms of because of the gerrymandering of districts, which was set up in 2011 by the Republican Party, after which people like Glenn Grossman said, well, the observation was that he was giddy because they would control the legislature for the next 10 years, and they've done that, and now they've got another 10 years because of a court decision. Specifically, what I want to say, ask Mr. Gilbert, is about the decision of the Wisconsin Supreme Court to take the map that had least change. That's their term. That's not a constitutional term. No one can find anything in the Constitution or law that says that that map needed to be least changed, that the whole process of redistricting was shaped by that decision in favor of the Republican Party once again and against democracy. And I think that decision of least change, in other words, that the maps that were there already drawn in a partisan manner by Republicans in 2011 must continue. And that's exactly what has happened. And the state of Wisconsin is going to live under an undemocratic system. We might have free elections where people can vote and vote without fraud, but they're not fair elections because they benefit the Republican Party.
And John, because we're short on time, I want Craig to respond there about the courts, because even we heard with the U.S. Supreme Court handing down last month its decision, that had been described as shocking and unprecedented. And just, you know, when we have divided government here, how the courts have this say in map drawing. Go ahead.
Yeah, so the courts have played a huge role in this, and it's a little complicated role. I mean, there have been, at the state Supreme Court, there have been cases where one member of the conservative majority has sided with the liberal members of the court to rule in ways the Republicans objected to. But overall, the overall effect of the totality of these rulings has been, you know, politically great for Republicans and terrible for Democrats. And the, you know, I'm not a legal expert, but sort of one perverse political aspect of the least change ruling is that it sort of, you know, created a legacy around one election, which was the 2010 election, which was a wave election, and gave it a kind of staying power with respect to this map going forward. The logic of least change is this map just sort of lives on in perpetuity as long as there's divided government and disputes, political disputes over the map. They defer to a map that was drawn in an election more than a decade earlier.
We are almost out of time here. What are you watching for next?
Well, we're set now for the lines for this fall's election. Going beyond November, you're going to see more litigation. There's also going to be a very important battle over the makeup of the state Supreme Court. You're going to see a big spring fight in 2023 over the court that has, as we've seen, has big implications for questions like redistricting.
Craig, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
Craig Gilbert is a fellow at the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education at Marquette University, previously ran the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau. Just ahead, we talk with two Wisconsin beef cattle farmers on this Earth Day about the feasibility and benefits of regenerative agriculture. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.